This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Historian Ian Kershaw has just completed the second volume of his biography of the man who is considered the embodiment of political evil, Adolf Hitler. Kershaw is the head of the history department at the University of Sheffield in England. Volume 2 covers the years 1936 to 45, the year of Hitler's suicide. I asked Kershaw what anti-Jewish measures were already in effect in 1936 when the new book begins.
Major steps of discrimination had, of course, already been underway ever since Hitler took power in Germany in January 1933. And the Jews had been forced out of many parts of the economy, already are subjected to major pressure. Most of all, most significantly of all, perhaps they have been forced out of some professions. And with the Nuremberg laws of September 1935, they have been officially turned into second-class citizens. That is to say, they were deprived of certain rights, and within the framework of the legislation, the notorious Nuremberg laws increased the screw of discrimination, was turned ever more tightly. So at this stage, in 1936, we just ended a phase of considerable anti-Semitic violence in the summer and autumn of 1935. By this time, the Nuremberg laws have come into operation, and by 1936, the outward appearance of discrimination, or at any rate of the outward violence towards the Jews, has been toned down because of foreign policy considerations, especially in the Olympic year, with the Winter Olympics in the February, the Summer Olympics coming up. It was important for Hitler now to put the best face upon Germany's outside image, and therefore for that year there was a rather quiet year in anti-Jewish policy. But this rather quiet year was simply a prelude to the greater explosion of violence which was to follow in late 1937, especially going into 1938.
The plan to exterminate the Jews was the culmination of a lot of smaller steps in Hitler's anti-Jewish campaign. Do you think that by 1936 he already had a vision of genocide, or do you think that that vision of genocide came a little bit later and he had other plans that he wanted to enact?
I think his overall vision of the distant future, it was a utopian vision, a terrible vision, but a utopian vision, was one in which there was no place for Jews. So you could say that implicitly this had a genocidal dimension. But in terms of any type of plan or program, concrete specific program for it, this emerged only in the course of 1941, in the light of, by then, 8 years of increasing anti-Jewish discrimination and anti-Jewish violence, which had then taken off particularly in the period after the invasion of Poland in September 1939. So we have a culmination of a lengthy process of escalating discrimination and violence.
There were Nazi anti-Jewish propaganda campaigns. Did Hitler think that that was necessary to convince the German people that the Jews were evil, or did it not take much convincing?
No, he did think, and those around him, most prominently in this case the propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels, did think that although the German public was anti-Semitically inclined, nonetheless propaganda was needed to convince them of the true nature of Jews from their perspective, from this completely perverse, distorted perspective, that the Jews were the epitome of evil. And that message had to be rammed home time and time again. And in this message, it had to be made plain to the German people what a threat to Germany the Jews posed. And that was not just the Jews who were within Germany, but as time went on increasingly and the policy moved to from expulsion of the Jews within Germany to the question of external conflict, then the image of the Jews had to be portrayed to the young people that the Jews were an evil and a threat which went way beyond German borders. They were behind Bolshevism in Moscow as they were behind capitalism in the City of London and Wall Street. So it was a universal threat, and to that extent propaganda was ceaseless in pumping up this threat of the Jews as the absolute major danger that the German vision faced.
One of the original plans for dealing with the Jews was to just remove them from Germany. And you say that one of the early plans for that was to expel the Jews to Central Africa. How seriously did Hitler and his men in the Reich take that plan?
For a short time, they did take it seriously. It was an old idea that had been kicked around for quite some while in extreme racist nationalist circles, not just in Germany. And the idea was mooted, in fact, in the 1930s, even outside Germany, for a while. It was talked about in France and in Poland. Even in Britain, there were extreme right-wing groupings, fascist, neo-fascist groupings, also not neo, real fascist groupings, who were then talking about this idea. But in Germany, the idea was taken up seriously in the summer of 1940, the possibility, after the victory over France, the possibility of expelling the German Jews, of deporting them to Madagascar. And Madagascar was a French possession and, of course, geographically a very long way away. But for that, at that time, it was a serious consideration, and that serious consideration lasted a few months, so that even by the autumn of 1940, plans had been still being reached about the possibility of setting up a Jewish reservation on Madagascar. Of course, it would have been a form of genocide in its own right, but a different form of genocide to the one which eventually materialized, the genocide where Jews would have been under German police control and would have been worked to death and would have died out through disease and malnutrition and so on over a lengthy period of time.
And it would have been out of sight of Germans and other Europeans.
Yes, I mean, the idea rapidly came to nothing because Britain didn't form any peace terms with Germany, so the prospect of transporting Jews across the seas, which Germany didn't control, was one that couldn't be entertained. And in any case, as the idea of a war against the Soviet Union took concrete shape in the winter of 1940 to 41, into the winter 1941, so the idea of a reservation moved from the impractical notion of Africa to a more practical consideration of deporting the Jews to the east, i.e. to the waste, to the Arctic waste of the Soviet Union, where again Jews would have been intended to die out through the forced labour, through slave labour, through malnutrition, through starvation, through the weather conditions, through being frozen to death, and so on and so forth. And it was again implicitly a genocidal idea.
It was in about 1941 that Hitler ordered his chiefs to come up with a final solution to the Jewish question. How explicit was Hitler in describing what he wanted and what he meant by a final solution?
Hitler wasn't very explicit at all, as far as we can tell from the evidence, from the source materials. The source materials, I have to say, are not wonderful at this point. Hitler's own actions remain somewhat clouded in the shadows. I'll immediately say on there that Hitler's moral and political responsibility for what was happening, his knowledge of what was happening, his approval of what was happening, his authorization of key steps is not in question. But the precise nature of his statements and his actions, that is less than 100% clear. And one of the reasons for that is that he had, of course, many discussions with the police chief, Heinrich Himmler, who was responsible for carrying out the Hitler's dirty works, let's say. And these were meetings just of the two of them. No minutes were kept, no notes were taken, except Himmler's desk diary notes of what was going to be said in the meeting. So we don't have any plain record of that. But everything points to the fact that what Hitler did repeatedly was to speak in these terrible, but somewhat vague generalities. And people understood or read into those what he was intending. So that the most likely interpretation is that there was never one specific order on a particular day to announce the arrival of the final solution, but rather a series of steps of escalation in which Hitler gave the decisive authorization or agreement or order, if you want to have it that way.
Nay said that there was a taboo in Hitler's entourage, an explicit reference to the mass killing of the Jews. And I think it's kind of interesting that Hitler could be demented enough to actually want the mass killing of the Jews, but that he was discreet enough to think that they shouldn't talk about it explicitly.
Yes. It is an oddity that, because obviously he was very closely involved in the war policy and in war leadership decisions and in foreign policy and so on. I think I just have to also say that in Hitler's own thinking, the war had to be a war against the Jews. So there was no difference in his eyes between the war leadership itself and the policies towards the Jews. The annihilation of the Jews, the murder of the Jews, was part and parcel of the war effort itself. When all that's said and done, you're right that there is an oddity there in that this remained within his, even his closest entourage, a taboo subject. It wasn't only Hitler, incidentally, though, who held to this taboo. Himmler, too, recognized the need for utmost secrecy in all this. Of course, it wasn't an entirely well-kept secret, but it wasn't the attempt to keep it secret was there. And Himmler said one of these meetings that this is a glorious secret which we must take with us to our graves. So there, too, Bormann and others around Hitler also recognized the need for this secrecy.
Why did they think they had to keep it secret? I mean, that might seem obvious to people who are sane, but I mean, these people were actually believed everything they said about Jews, and they were perfectly, they were not only willing, they were enthusiastic about the extermination of the Jews.
That's true, but I think the most likely guess is that they were nonetheless uncertain about the impact on German morale of the knowledge of what they were doing. And that doesn't contradict the point we were making earlier on, that Hitler did think that anti-Jewish propaganda was effective. On the other hand, I think Hitler and Himmler and Bormann and the others were hesitant about the impact of the knowledge that not only were Jews being deported to the East, but Jewish women and children were being slaughtered en masse. And the sense that they had, I think, was that the German people were not ready for this sort of information, and that might have had, had from their angle, then negative effects, and they wanted to avoid that. They'd had some indication of the possible difficulties that had come about, of course, with the so-called euthanasia action towards the inmates of asylums between 1939 and 1941, which had given rise, once the people had learnt that these inmates were being killed, then that had given rise to some protests and certainly big feelings of unease about what was going on. And in the middle of a war, I think the Nazi leadership, Hitler quite specifically, wanted to avoid any sort of possible upset of that kind, which could disturb the war effort, could affect morale, and not least affect his own prestige and his own standing, something which he was always highly conscious of. So I think that's the most likely explanation for why the Nazis attempted to keep the thing an entire secret, and why, therefore, in this very extreme fashion, Hitler too didn't refer to it in any specific, in any particular kind, but again held to these more general comments, even amongst his own entourage.
In 1944, there was a failed military coup against Hitler. Who was behind the attempt to assassinate Hitler?
This was a group of officers. At the center of the attempt was Colonel Stauffenberg, who by this time had reached the conclusion that Hitler had to be destroyed, had to be assassinated as the basis for a coup d'etat that would follow, whereby the war would be brought to an end, and Germany would, even at this late stage now, be saved. So the idea was then, of course, to kill Hitler, which was a difficult enough enterprise. It was mainly after this, by this time, well-secured headquarters in East Prussia, or at his Alpine retreat in the Berghof. He had to be killed there, but the coup attempt had to be unleashed from Berlin. And one of the logistical difficulties and major flaws in the attempt was that Stauffenberg was one of the few people who had reason to have access to Hitler, as the basically from his role in the reserve army, as the deputy head of the reserve army, he had access to Hitler, which was needed, but also Stauffenberg was needed to run the coup attempt from Berlin. And between these two roles, of course, things went hopelessly awry on the 20th of July 1944.
How close did this plot come to actually assassinating Hitler?
Well, it came very close, and there historians frequently ignore or underrate the factor of luck or bad luck in the writing of history, but here we have to say that ultimately when Stauffenberg got there, planted the bomb and so on, that bad luck played a major part. Nearly all those around Hitler were badly injured and some of them were killed. Hitler was came out of the room with only burst eardrums and tattered underpants. All those around him were, as I said, were injured or killed, with, I think, the exception of his right-hand man in the army, Field Marshal Keitel, who was also uninjured. So, in the end, it was really bad luck. And even that, you could add another piece of bad luck onto that, which is that the planning for the bomb, there should have been two bombs. And because of the shortage of time on that day, Stauffenberg had been unable to set the second bomb. If there had been two, or even if the second bomb had been taken into the room, the explosion of the first bomb would have probably detonated the second one, and not a single person would have been left alive. But as it so happened, he didn't. He wasn't able to do it. He took one bomb in, and as we know, the bomb didn't really have the desired effect, and Hitler was able to walk out of the room and with remarkably slight injuries. So bad luck also played its major part, and that came very close to success. And if that had been successful, then quite possibly, in fact, probably, I should say, the coup d'etat that should have followed it would also stood a very good chance of success.
Would you describe the bunker that Hitler and other Reich leaders hid out in during the burning of Berlin?
In the last weeks, I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. This was an underground complex of rooms beneath the Reich Chancellery in the middle of Berlin, and also beneath the gardens of the Reich Chancellery. So a whole complex, a labyrinthine complex of rooms there. And this is now some 20 or 30 feet below ground. Hitler had moved down there basically from arriving back in Berlin early in 1945. He was at that time still partly in the increasingly ruined buildings of the Reich Chancellery, but increasingly underground, and in the last weeks hardly ever came up to the surface. So yeah, this really most bizarre spectacle, really, of the leader of this Reich now confining himself to this underground set of rooms with his entourage around him, these people in the catacombs deep below the center of Berlin, and that it was almost like a sufficiently saturnine end to this terrible regime.
Also in the bunker was Eva Braun, Hitler's lover. In fact, they got married in the bunker, I think about a day and a half before they killed themselves. What did you learn about the wedding?
Well, the wedding came as a surprise to everyone. I think no one until that a few hours before it had any inkling that this would take place. And on the day itself, which is the 29th of April 1945, Eva Braun gave one or two hints to the secretaries that it would take place, and then in the middle of the night the wedding was formalized in this weird set of surroundings in the bunker underneath Berlin, with a hastily improvised ceremony with a few of the Nazi leaders and the usual entourage around, very abbreviated celebrations, obviously very little to celebrate at that time. The question is really why Hitler did it, and I suppose the most likely explanation is probably the correct one, which is that by this stage he'd already decided to commit suicide. There was nothing left for him to gain out of his continued public image of being unattached to any woman, and that now he gave Eva Braun what she wanted, which is possibly the most unattractive fate in the world, which was to marry Hitler a day before he would kill himself.
And before she killed herself.
Exactly, yeah.
So Hitler didn't want the German public to know about his relationship with Eva Braun.
No, hardly anyone apart from the close entourage of Hitler did know about this relationship until after the end of the Third Reich itself. The reason again was a propaganda one, essentially, that From the beginning, Hitler had emphasized the fact that he belonged to no woman, that there was that his bride was Germany, so to say, and he represented the German people and was not going to be distracted by any human concerns or normal considerations. And in a way, a little bit, I suppose, like you might think with pop stars, you know, so Elvis Presley can't belong to any one woman or something like this, I don't know. But there was that element to it as well, that Hitler had to be seen to be distant from any type of conventional relationship with a woman around him. And earlier on, this had also been a conscious attempt to woo the women of Germany, and I think that idea was held to right to the end, that Hitler was there for the German people and not for any one individual who might distract him from that.
What's your final diagnosis of Hitler? Do you see him as insane, as a sociopath?
I don't think he was insane in a clinical sense of the word, that is to say, someone that you would want to take out and lock up in an asylum. Maybe it would have been better for everyone in the world in general if that had happened, but I don't think he was insane in that sense. Rather, there was an element there which was obviously very abnormal about his personality, and I think it may be possible to see that in terms of someone who fits into a broad category of schizophrenia, that is to say, someone who has an abnormally large gulf between self-image and achievement, going right back to his early years there, where he had this vision of himself as a great artist, and the reality was that he was a very mediocre painter. He had the image of himself of greatness from early days, and he sank down into the gutter and into the tramp's hostel in Vienna, and therefore I think probably there was a deep-seated sense of personal humiliation in the man from an early stage onwards, which at the end of the First World War, I think that was the critical moment in his life, really, if you can point to one. At the end of the First World War, this sense of personal humiliation matched up with a deep-seated sense of national humiliation, and his entire life thereafter, his entire so-called career, could be seen as an attempt to erase the shame of the capitulation of November 1918. And who did Hitler hold to blame for that shame of capitulation? The Jews. Hence, another war would bring Germany's triumph, its dominance in Europe and then later in the world. It would bring the attainment of living space to secure Germany's future forevermore, and it would bring the final eradication of the danger of the Jews. So for Hitler then, the war that he planned all along that had to come was, by definition, also a war against the Jews. So I see Hitler as a person who, from this somewhat schizophrenic personal framework, held strongly to this obsession. This sort of individual then tends to have visions, tends to have diabolical images to counter these visions, to look for scapegoats for that, for his or her own individual shortcomings, individual humiliation and blame. And I think that all fits in the individual Hitler, who then, from 1919 onwards, found all at once that instead of just being the eccentric, which he'd been seen to be up to then, now was a person whose eccentricities, if we put it that way now, were gaining, finding an audience. And that heightened then the sense in him that he was a man with a vision, a man with a mission. And I think that is what Hitler was. His mission was a terrible one. His vision was a horrendous one for humankind. But this was a man who was then, by this stage, not only a supreme propagandist, but also an absolutely obsessive ideologue.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Yeah, it's a great pleasure.
Ian Kershaw has completed the second volume of his biography of Hitler. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today was Joan Tui Westman. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Monique Nazareth, and Phyllis Myers, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, and Patty Leswing. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a German propaganda recording from the war, one of a series of propaganda records that featured popular American songs with rewritten lyrics that are anti-Jewish and anti-American. They were intended for airplay on German-controlled radio stations that reached English-speaking listeners.
The Jews of USA have asked Eddie Cantor to write a new version of his famous old-timer Making Whoopee. In one of his latest programs on the air, he sang the following song. another war, another prophet, another Jewish business trick, another season, another reason for making whoopee. A lot of dough, a lot of gold, the British Empire's being sold. We're in the money, thanks to Frankie, we're making whoopee. Washington is our ghetto, Roosevelt our king. Democracy is our motto, think what a war can bring. We throw our German names away, we are the kikes of USA. You are the goys, folks, we are the boys, folks, we're making whoopee.